I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. A refinery in South Philadelphia that dates back to the Civil War is shutting down after an explosion and fire last month. Philadelphia Energy Solutions, the largest oil refinery on the East Coast, had just emerged from bankruptcy and last week told the 1,000 workers at the facility that they were losing their jobs. Two employees have sued PES, claiming the company did not comply with laws requiring a 60-day notice before layoffs. While workers at the company have made a good living, the facility is the city's largest fixed-site polluter, something that has angered and worried local residents. Philadelphia Mayor Kenney has organized a task force to determine what happened and to provide guidance about what to do next. The company says it's looking for a new buyer. Today on Radio Times, we talk about the economic impact of what happened at PES and its environmental legacy. Joining us is Brian Abernathy. He's Philadelphia's managing director, also co-chair of this newly created task force. And Brian Abernathy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Peter DiCarlo, associate professor of environmental engineering and chemistry at Drexel University, where his research focuses on climate and air quality and has looked at this site at PES. And Peter DiCarlo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And we want to hear from you, especially if you live near these facilities, if you work at these facilities, call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Brian, let me begin with you and sort of reading about all the things that happened sort of leading up to our conversation today, and specifically what happened in June. How close we were to something really catastrophic?
We were very close. I think both PES and our fire department personnel did an amazing job in their response. Safety measures worked the way they were supposed to. And I think we've learned some things from the response, specifically around communication. But I think we were close. And without some heroics, both by PES personnel and the fire department, we would be having a very different conversation today.
In fact, I was reading about an employee, unnamed, who really, prevented a potentially environmental disaster.
Yes, and that's exactly what that staff is trained to do, and that's why that control room is manned 24/7, she and her coworkers did an amazing job.
Right, and what did they specifically do that we know of anyway?
They were able to identify the leak quickly, and then when that leak was identified, they were able to siphon off the hydrogen fluoride into another container, and that, in and of itself, saved countless lives and stopped what would have been an environmental and public safety disaster.
Do we know what caused it?
We do not know yet.
It seems like it started with a leak.
We know that there was a leak. We don't know what caused that leak, and still under active investigation.
In fact, let me play a clip, and this is Kristen Kulinowski. She's executive authority at the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, addressing the PES refinery fire at a recent press conference. I should add audio provided by WHYY's Susan Phillips. Let's give it a listen.
On the morning of June 21st, there was a fundamental failure in this system. And the result, as we have seen in other investigations, was catastrophic. The employees and the community are fortunate that there were no serious injuries or fatalities.
She talks about a fundamental failure. What do you think do you see it that way?
Absolutely.
And there was a fire earlier in June, right?
There was a fire earlier in June. That fire was related to a sewage system and a sewage pump. I think the two events are completely unrelated, except potentially around maintenance. And we're going to look at those issues as we go forward. And certainly, we've challenged PES to be able to explain those things. And again, our fire department retains jurisdiction and police department, working closely with our both federal and state partners to really understand exactly what happened. And then we'll also do a post-event review to understand what we could have done better, because, I think our first responders did an amazing job, mm-hmm. There are things that we could always improve upon. And again, I understand from the community, communication is one of those things.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, whether people felt like they were given enough warning and told to do the right things, many told to shelter in place.
I think folks were told to do the right thing, but there were some from our Ready Alert system. There were some mixed messages, or not everyone who should have received alerts did receive alerts. Those are things that we're reviewing and correcting as we speak.
Peter DiCarlo, let me turn to you and just help us understand. Again, this did not materialize, but I want to make sure people understand what was at stake here. We're talking about a cloud of hydrogen fluoride. What do we need to know about that?
Hydrogen fluoride is probably one of the most caustic chemicals that we use. And had that been released, it could have, as mentioned previously, been deadly and a massive public health problem. Fortunately, that was averted. And yeah, I mean, I just thank God that it was.
I mean, I don't mean to be hysterical here, but I mean, if it had been released, what are we talking about?
I mean, people dying. Let me put it this way: I'm in a chemistry department. If you use HF in the lab, you have to take extra special precautions. And so, you know, you're already dealing with a bunch of different chemicals in a chemistry lab. HF is one of those things that's even another level of dangerous. And so, having that, if that had been released into that neighborhood in a populated area, it would have been catastrophic.
Wow, and you're nodding your head, Ryan.
Yes, I would agree.
Help us understand, and this site has been described, the city's largest fixed site polluter. And we should say it's a sprawling facility that includes tanks and rail cars and all of that. Help us understand what that means by the largest fixed site polluter.
So to emit air pollution in an urban environment, or really anywhere, you need a permit. And so those permits give you an idea of how much is being emitted by a facility. If you sum up all of the facilities in Philadelphia, PES makes up over 50% and generally more than 75% of most of the major pollutants that we track in the city. But those are for fixed sites. So those are for industrial complexes. That doesn't include vehicle emissions. And so vehicle emissions are on par or similar to kind of all the industrial emissions as well. And so when we think about the air quality of the city in general, it's the mixture of all those sources. But from a single facility that doesn't move, PES is by far the largest currently and historically.
And what kind of pollutants?
We're talking about carbon monoxide, particulate matter, and so that's little particles in the air that we breathe that get into our lungs. And we're talking about things that are, you know, 100 times smaller than the diameter of your hair. Those are the particles that we're talking about, volatile organic compounds. And in particular with the refinery, one of the things that we're most concerned with are called the BTEX compounds. And so this is benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. And those are known carcinogens, and they're part of the refining process. They're in our gasoline, they're in diesel. And so these are the things that you expect to be released in just the normal operation of a refinery. And the levels of those releases are quite high.
You talk about the amount of pollution there. Was it EPA compliant? Were they beyond the EPA requirements for a facility such as this? Do we know?
So the Clean Air Act, if you look at the compliance with the Clean Air Act, which governs most of the air pollution, the last 9 of the 12 quarters that they've been inspected have found a major violation to the Clean Air Act and violations to the Clean Water Act. And so they're not 100% in compliance by any means. Are they in compliance with their permits? I mean, if you look at each individual stack, generally they are, but that doesn't mean that that's a good thing to be released in the middle of an urban environment with, you know, 6 million people or so in the greater Philadelphia area.
Well, let me go back to you, Brian. And this is a facility that, I mean, dates back to the Civil War. And obviously the city grew up around it. That was probably countryside back in, you know, 1860 or the time that it was first operational. In today's environment, we wouldn't put a refinery in the middle of a neighborhood, would we?
No. And I think you hit the nail on the head that the refinery opened and the city grew around it. The community grew around it. And certainly we wouldn't diminish the significant environmental impacts that PES has had recently and you know, going back over 100 years. It is an important economic engine and job creator, but at the same time, we need to mitigate some of those negative effects as we go forward as well.
Well, and that's what makes this complicated, right? Because we're talking about good-paying jobs, I was reading the average sum like $42 an hour. That's a good paying job. Mm-hmm. Skilled workforce. So the city, the region wants those people, right?
Absolutely. You know, these are
and needs them in a way.
We need those jobs. We you know, these are blue collar workers who whose families depend upon those salaries. They're very good paying jobs that aren't going to be easy to replace.
Right.
And I think we're very concerned about finding new homes for those folks. Preferably new jobs in Philadelphia. But we're also not naive. That's going to be a hard task. We're going to do everything we can to work with the union and the trades to make that happen. And we'll see what happens, again, with the site. And I think we'll probably get into that in a little while about what does the future look like?
Well, I'm curious about we're talking about potentially 1,000 jobs or 1,000 people, I guess, who could lose their jobs as a result of all this.
I would say 1,000 people that are directly related to PES, but there's a host of secondary jobs that businesses that worked with PES, contractors that worked on site that will also be impacted. And right now, frankly, we don't understand exactly what those impacts are going to be and how many other businesses are going to be infected what their true economic impact actually will be.
Does the city want PES to stay open and try to fix the problem, or is that are we beyond that at this point?
I think we're beyond the whether PES can stay open or not. While I think we, frankly, the economics were that if they were going to repair that facility, and it would be a significant capital investment that would have taken time, and so they would have been idle, spending money and not earning any money, and that in and of itself is a challenging economic equation to make work. What we do want to see is the refinery. And this is what the task force will really focus on. We want to see the refinery become a job creator that is both safe for the environment and also safe for the surrounding community.
Well, that doesn't sound like refining oil then. If that's the goal.
And I would also say that I think we have some limited control over what happens as well. PES is a private venture. I think we may have some levers and influence over what goes there and what we can see happen there. But I do think a refinery could be a potential use. I don't think the city is going to rule that out. Again, those jobs are important, and not to mention the impact it has on the surrounding region. I think the use of HF specifically is something that we're deeply concerned about. And I think the other important piece here is we need to remember that the refinery is actually two separate refineries as well. And so we're looking at two different sites.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Brian Abernathy. He's Philadelphia's managing director. Also with us, Peter DiCarlo. He's associate professor of environmental engineering and chemistry at Drexel University. His research focuses on climate and air quality. We are talking about the nearly catastrophic fire and explosion at Philadelphia Energy Solutions. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the fact that Philadelphia Energy Solutions is shutting down after a recent fire and series of explosions. We're talking about the economic impact and the refinery's environmental legacy. Let me play something that Mayor Kinney said addressing the PES refinery at a press conference.
Those who live and work in close proximity to the refinery and all Philadelphians have our word. We are firmly committed to ensuring the safe operation of this refinery and the safety of those in its vicinity. I do not believe that there is room for improvement. I do believe that there is room for improvement, both in the operation of the refinery and in the communications to residents. That's why last Friday I asked Managing Director Brian Abernathy and Commissioner Teal to convene a working group with the leadership of PES, as well as members of the Community Advisory Panel, United Steelworkers, Philadelphia Building Trades, and other experts to fully explore all of our concerns.
And I should say that Brian Abernathy is sitting with us here in our Philadelphia studios, as well as Peter DiCarlo from Drexel University. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Peter, I want to talk to you more about this particular site and the kind of pollution that it has created, and compare that to Marcellus Shale. This is something that you actually did as your homework, I guess, for today's show, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I have done this before, and I did it again last night for the most recent number. So this is for the 2017 emission inventory for both the Marcellus and for PES, and these numbers are available from the Toxic Release Inventory or from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. But basically, the BTEX compounds that I talked about before, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, the known cancer-causing chemicals, if you take the emissions reported for PES and the emissions from the Marcellus and you look at them in a comparison, PES emits about 81% of the total of the Marcellus Shale, which covers about half the state. So you're taking those emissions, condensing them down to a single point, and then releasing them in an urban area. And that's, you know, people are up in arms about Marcellus and that development. This is our backyard. This is where, you know, I live 2 miles from the refinery. Right. You know, these are things that are concerning.
Well, and residents have expressed a lot of concern, and there's some sometimes it's hard to sort of figure out cause and effect, but there are some potential health hazards, it seems.
Yeah, certainly. And this is, you know, these are clearly health impactful. We know all of these chemicals do cause cancer. And so the people, especially the people who live closest to the refinery, are going to get the highest concentrations. And as things move away from the refinery, as the air moves away, it dilutes. And so the concentrations will decrease with distance from the refinery. But, you know, excluding the fire, just normal operation of a refinery, you get exposure to these chemicals.
Well, and what about soil? I mean, what happens if when some of these particulates sort of trickle down into the soil or even the water supply?
I mean, this is a site that's been refining oil for over 100 years. And, you know, the EPA came in 1970 and the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act at the same time. And so prior to that, we don't have as much environmental regulation. And so things that happened at that site prior to the EPA are also quite damaging. And that legacy remains with us today. And so, you know, my understanding is before the Model T came out and before we had a need for gasoline, that fraction of the distillate, that fraction of the refining product or that product was just dumped on the ground because they didn't have a need for it. And there was no Environmental Protection Agency. And so that is part of the legacy of the refinery.
And that's still, I mean, it's sitting there now. I mean, no matter what happens, that the ground is there.
Yes, it will need to be remediated.
It will need to, is that something, do you see that as a city's responsibility, Brian, or?
So the remediation of the site, from my understanding, is actually belongs to Sunoco, the prior operator. At least that's my understanding of the liability. Now, that is something that's we're going to review as part of the working group. But at least as I sit here today, my belief is that the environmental cleanup of the site is really Sunoco's responsibility.
Oh. What is the responsibility of the working group or the task force?
Initially, you know, when the mayor called for the working group, it was really about, okay, there was an explosion. How do we – was our response appropriate? Was our notifications appropriate? And then how do we – you know, is the refinery operating in a safe manner? And how do we make sure that it's operating for a safe manner in the future for the surrounding community and for the workers who are there every day? Shortly thereafter, actually the day after the clip that you played, the refinery announced its closure. Mm-hmm. That shifted the working group's focus from how do we make sure the refinery is operating safely to what do we do with the refinery and how do we make sure that future uses are both environmentally better. Because I think the challenges there are very real, and the challenges of the ground, you know, operating for nearly 160 years as a refinery is going to create some very difficult issues, as well as how do we make sure we protect as many jobs and good paying jobs as we possibly can, but at the same time, really include the community in a conversation about what that reuse looks like. But we have to have a realistic conversation. You know, we're not going to have a playground on this site. We're not going to turn this into green space or parks and recreation space. This is an industrial site that has over 100 years of pollutants. That is going to be, if it becomes reused, is likely to be another industrial site.
And you shook your head saying no playgrounds, no parks, Peter.
Yeah, that would be a nightmare. I mean, you can't redevelop this site to the point where it would be clean enough to put people, and especially children, the dangers for, you know, chronic disease or cancer or other ailments would just be astronomical. It wouldn't be worth the risk. So, yeah, I mean, that is a great question. What do you do with it? I mean, I think the city is really trying hard to be sustainable and has this, you know, sustainability focus. And so maybe we really talk to the community and talk to the city and talk to the workers about how we can best meet everyone's goals and move forward. And I think, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with that site. I really hope that it moves us forward. You know, as a climate scientist, having a refinery in the city in which I live is something that I am uncomfortable with, not only from the air pollution perspective, but knowing that I have two children who are going to grow up in a different climate than I grew up in. And what we can do as a city to move us beyond fossil fuel infrastructure would be great.
Well, and as you mentioned, you live 2 miles away, but imagine living just around the corner, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, should people be worried about their backyards if they live close to this facility?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know the extent historically. I don't know if we have good records, but you know, it's something that potentially testing could be done and we could get a better idea. And that's something that would probably fall on either the city or Sunoco.
You know, Brian, I'm thinking of the fact that Hahnemann is scheduled to lay off workers, just, you know, sort of another added burden, I guess, that the city's trying to manage, trying to figure out where do you find jobs for these people and can you keep them local?
You know, last week was a very challenging week. I mean, we saw, you know, the loss of 3,500 jobs essentially in one day. You know, we are very focused on, you know, how do we move that forward? We are holding job fairs, large job fairs towards the end of the month, to really identify what positions people might be able to fill, especially in the case of Hahnemann around nurses and some of the lower level paid individuals. You know, around PES, it's really about where do these folks slot in? We're even looking at city jobs. We've had trouble filling our trade position. So is there an opportunity to figure out how do we slot folks into those positions? Right. We're trying to be as creative as possible, trying to break down as many barriers as possible. But these are huge economic impacts. And again, it's not just the direct jobs that are going to be impacted. It's going to be all the suppliers that both supplied PES and Hahnemann. It's going to be about the people, surrounding restaurants, surrounding stores. This is a big impact on Philadelphia in a very short period of time, and this mayor is very committed to protecting the workers to the best of our ability and making sure that those people stay in Philadelphia, find employment in Philadelphia, and that we can continue to grow as a city.
Do you think there are enough jobs? I mean, and we're talking about well-paying jobs, skilled workers, good benefits. Do those jobs exist in Philadelphia?
Some of those jobs exist. Do we have enough? I don't know.
Oh, you don't know. I mean, too soon to tell.
I think it's too soon to tell.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Brian Abernathy, Philadelphia's Managing Director. Also with us, Peter DiCarlo, Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering and Chemistry at Drexel University. His work focuses on climate and air quality. We've been talking about the recent fire and explosion at Philadelphia Energy Solutions. The company has announced it is shutting down, looking for someone to possibly buy the facility, and also talking about the fact that we're looking at the potential of maybe 1,000 layoffs, something like that. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments and we'll get Lisa from Phoenixville to join us. Annabelle says, it woke me up. This would be the explosion, I guess. I live near Argonne, South 5th Street. I thought it was thunder. A coworker said her husband, who works at the refinery, has received no direct notification from PES that discuss next steps or whether they're getting their last paycheck or not. And Brian, I heard that some people have already lost their jobs. No severance, as I understand it.
That's my understanding.
Right. And I mean, anything else do we know? Have you been in touch with PES about sort of how they're going to wind down some of these workers?
So we've been in consistent communication with them, encouraging them to do right by their workers, mm-hmm. at least to the best of their ability. Their initial layoffs were, I believe yesterday, mm-hmm. Was approximately 100, a little more than 100 employees, with the remainder to be laid off on July 12th. They do intend to maintain a small maintenance and security crew. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we haven't put the incident under control yet. Our biggest concern is making sure that their fire suppression unit and some of those public safety initiatives are still in place. That's a very short notice, and from my understanding, the union is challenging PES's lack of a 60-day notice as required. I don't know how that's going to play out, but we're certainly there's certain things that are outside of the city's control, and so we're really focused on I may not be able to stop those layoffs, but how do I help those workers going forward? What services can I provide? Emotional support can we provide? What can we do to help those individuals?
Mm. I read that two employees have actually sued PES. They're claiming the company did not comply with laws on the books, I think federal and also state laws, saying that there must be a 60-day notice before layoffs.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. And we'll have to see how that plays out. PS is claiming an emergency status, which would allow them to waive those requirements. I am concerned about how quickly this has all unfolded, certainly makes our job more difficult in providing the support for those workers that they deserve. They've spent their entire career there. They have dedicated their lives to PES and that refinery, it's been a lifeblood for South Philadelphia and the surrounding community. To pick up and close overnight, essentially, is devastating.
An email from Jenna says, I grew up in the shadow of the refineries and have had chronic sinus problems my whole life, which I've always blamed on the refineries. Are there any discussions about health damages suffered by residents of Grays Ferry, Southwest Philly, and their future health care? I know, Peter, you're a scientist, mm-hmm. But nonetheless, there is, again, trying to figure out cause and effect can be very tricky when you're talking about environmental threats to people.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to the refinery, you also have major interstates, you have the airport, you have other facilities in that region too. So, and the port as well. So, attributing anything to a single source is a very difficult proposition. But certainly, the risk increases when you have more sources and more emissions in your neighborhood.
How do you think the community should be involved going forward?
I mean, I think the community bears a lot of the brunt of what happens at that site. Wind generally moves from the west to the east, and so the community that is downwind is going to be the ones who are going to be most affected historically and moving forward. So they're the ones that really should have some say in what air they're going to be breathing and what is going to be going into that air. So I think that dialogue is also important. I think the workers and getting them compensated and finding places for them is definitely incredibly important, but also, the health of the people who live in that neighborhood is also mm-hmm. equally important.
Are they going to be part of the task force? Are there going to be community representatives part of the task force, Brian?
Yes, the community will be included in the task force, and we'll certainly have committed to a community process, including a community meeting before the end of the month. To Peter's point, they have to be involved. They right. deserve to be involved, and we need to hear their voices about what the future of that site holds.
Catalina wonders, do your guests know how many of those workers live in Philadelphia? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head, no.
Right. Let me get Lisa. Lisa calling us from Phoenixville. And Lisa, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
And I was hearing about the jobs, and it's devastating. And I'm really sorry for all those families. But I do think that there is an opportunity here if our legislators and the city of Philadelphia can come together with the trades. We can move toward renewable energy in our municipal and school buildings. And we've done this in the school district where I'm an elected board member. We save taxpayers $70,000 a year by having geothermal into schools. And while geothermal is not the answer in the urban schools, solar is, wind is, renewable is, and we can create thousands of jobs while saving taxpayers millions of dollars by making this investment now. And that is what we need to do.
Lisa, you're welcome. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Brian, I mean, do you see that as an option, which is to say, here are talented, skilled people. We would put them to work in the solar energy business versus refining oil.
I think it is absolutely an option. I mean, the city of Philadelphia has the largest single solar contract of any municipality in the country, and something that's been, you know, I think the mayor is very proud of. We're building our own solar farm in Pennsylvania.
Where's that?
It will be in the.
You're looking at Peter. I'm looking at Peter.
No, it is in the. I want to say it's York County, but it is in another county. But that is to serve Philadelphia's needs specifically, and that project is something we're really proud of. You know, and as we look at PES and its potential, renewable energy is a potential. But mm-hmm. I also think we need to remember that a solar farm it does not provide the same number of jobs as a refinery does. And so, while I think it is part of the solution, and I'm not sure it is all of the solution for the workers.
How do you see it, Peter?
I mean, I think. Using that as it's an energy hub now, but transitioning it to renewable or clean energy would be something that would be great. But, I mean, I think, a solar farm, when operating at low maintenance, doesn't need as many workers as the refinery needs. And so you still need to find places for those other workers. And, you know, the river's also tidal there. There's a potential for tidal energy. There's all sorts of interesting other options. But it's certainly something that, you know, if it became an energy hub that wasn't fossil based, it would really be in line with the city's sustainability goals, and I think it would be much better for the environment and the neighborhood surrounding the current refinery.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the fire and conflagration, the explosions at Philadelphia Energy Solutions in late June. The company is shutting down. It's part of the facility there. We're talking about the economic impact, what happens to the jobs, what happens to the workers, what happens to the facility, and also the refinery's environmental legacy. Again, talking with Brian Abernathy, Philadelphia's managing director, and Peter DiCarlo from Drexel University. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Join our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we are talking about Philadelphia Energy Solutions shutting down after a recent fire and a series of explosions in South Philadelphia, talking about the economic impact of some of the layoffs and the closure itself, and of course talking about the refinery's environmental legacy. Let me just play a clip. This is the United Steelworkers Union President Ryan O'Callaghan in an interview on WHYY.
Well, everyone is... I guess devastated. They wonder what their future lies for them and their families. Will they have to move? Will they find work? People are discussing, you know, with their spouses if they have to move, where they're going to move to, what part of the country, what refiner if possible. If they don't move, what kind of job they can get, their children. You know, two guys on my operating unit just bought houses. Two young people just bought houses. And their wives just had babies. So they're completely devastated. So they thought they had a future. And within the last 2 months, they purchased houses. And their wives had children. I mean, it's just dismay. And people are angry because, you know, we know that that place can run. And run efficiently and make money. And we feel that maybe the company's just cashing in the chips and walking out the gate with maybe the insurance money. And it's just not right.
So what do you think of that, Brian? I mean, it's sad. It's sad to hear about people losing these jobs their investment in this place.
Like I said earlier, this is devastating. It's devastating to those families, the families that depended on this refinery, again, dedicated their lives, in some cases their entire careers to the refinery. The rug got pulled out from under them. And it's, you know, we're committed to trying to help those folks. and figure out what our next steps are for the refinery to make sure that those people can find new jobs. But we don't have a whole lot of time to do that. And I'm expecting that, you know, some people will make a decision to move on to a different refinery or move on to a different vocation. That's devastating. It's devastating for those families. It's devastating for the city.
I want to make sure people understand this sprawling complex. So we're talking about refineries. We're talking about a tank farm, rail storage facilities, obviously highways going by as well.
Yes, it's 1,400 acres. It's a huge sprawling complex that takes up two separate refineries. It's not an easy challenge that we're facing.
In fact, we were having an interesting conversation even before going on the air, Pierre. I'll toss this to you about, back in the day, we're talking about the 19th mm-hmm. century, that yeah. this was a part of Philadelphia where the rich would, move, get out of the city in the summer and enjoy some breezes, I guess, along the river there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the west side of the Schuylkill River was a bunch of mansions for the wealthy of Philadelphia back before the refinery went into that location. And so, the Bartram's Garden is what's left of that era. It's also an access point to the river, though. And something that also should be mentioned, it's not just 1,400 continuous acres. The Schuylkill River runs through the complex, right through the middle. And so that is a public waterway. And, there is, options for people to get on the water and get through that space. And so, maybe that could factor into some way of reuse.
Yeah, interesting. And obviously with the port there as well, which Philadelphia wants to maintain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think port uses are one of the things that we'll certainly be exploring. I think the waterway is a huge asset. And there's a lot of potential that we hope to be able to tap into.
Well, and it is interesting, Peter, to think about. I mean, the city has this own goal that by 2050, an 80% reduction of greenhouse gases without PES, is the city on better track to make it? Knowing, of course, there are economic and personal consequences to that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's a huge greenhouse gas emitter as well. The refining process is energy intensive. And then, we're not even counting the product that comes out of the refinery in that total of Philadelphia emissions. But if we were, I think we would be below that, because that's millions of gallons of gasoline that are no longer going to be burned or coming out of the city. So, yeah, it certainly helps, but we have a long way to go to fully reach that goal.
How do you see, does losing this sort of reconfigure what that goal is, Brian?
I think we're regardless of what this does to the goal, I think we're still committed to reducing the energy cost to our buildings, reducing how vehicles are used on our streets, improving mass transportation. Those are all things that we need to do, not just for the city, but for our future as a country and and for the earth. We have a lot of work to do, I think I'll give a lot of credit to our office's sustainability, who has really driven this effort, not just to talk about it, but actually driving it through our operating departments and making it part of kind of a thread through all of our work.
I'm thinking about those workers who were at the facility when all this happened and what they did to prevent really a catastrophe, and then to lose your job on top of that.
It's devastating. I mean, it's crushing. And again, these are men and women who, have come to work every day, have taken their job seriously, have tried to operate the refinery to the best of their ability, and now they feel like, they feel betrayed. I think your point is well taken. These are folks that, put their lives on the line, frankly, to protect the surrounding community and protect the city, and then to lose your job on top of it is I can't imagine being in those shoes.
Let me just quote Kristen Kulinowski again, where she says, refining is a high hazard industry. These hydrocarbons are flammable and explosive, and that's why safety management systems are in place to prevent their unintentional release. What do you, Peter, going forward, what do you want to know? And we still can't get inside these facilities because they're still too dangerous. But what do you want to learn? What's important for us to know about?
In terms of the...
Just sort of what happened and even the environmental consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we very visually saw these plumes of black smoke coming out of the refinery. We know that there was a lot of air pollution emitted. The local monitoring networks weren't well positioned to see the plume. They're in place in a regulatory framework. They're not in place for an industrial accident. And so, you know, there are examples of other places where, you know, where you do get a plume and you can start to see at least where it's going, using low cost sensors. So for example, in the Bay Area, when there were the fires last summer, in San Francisco last summer, there were fires, and a lot of people, it's more tech savvy, I think, area. A lot of people have what are called purple airs, and they're not the most accurate, but they could at least identify where the plume was and give you an idea of what the concentrations were, you know, within a factor of two or so. I have a colleague in Montana who works a lot on wildfires, and the state of Montana maintains portable air pollution monitoring equipment that they can basically spread out and put in a network when there's a wildfire, so they can identify where the plumes are going. And so having these types of technologies in place for knowing where plumes are going is something that, you know, maybe could be thought about and looking forward, and how to get these types of networks in place or have the resources to do that.
But it's too
late now. Obviously, this is a retrospective. So, you know, obviously we want to do better and better understand who's affected, where they're infected, and what the potential areas of concern are. But we were essentially pretty blind to the plumes when they happened.
And by plumes, just so I make sure everyone knows what you're talking about, by plumes, I mean, I can visualize one, but I want to make sure that's what you mean.
Yeah, so basically, like, the black smoke that you see, there were some flares, the fire itself, some of that gets lofted and will come touch down farther downwind, where it's a little bit more diluted, but some of it was at ground level. You could see that in the videos. But it goes with the wind, and so the wind will take that air pollution wherever the wind is blowing, and looked like most of it was going a little bit mostly to the east, but maybe a little bit north when the initial blast happened, and then towards the rest of the day it was mostly east with a little bit of a southerly component.
Right. And my understanding, Brian, is that the health department sort of said everything's okay. I mean, this was shortly after, I guess, the initial explosions.
So the health department deployed their monitoring devices quickly to monitor air quality. And found no significant issues throughout that deployment. I think what Peter's talking about is really a different type of air pollution that is going to have a potential long-term impact. I think one of the things that I would say, no matter what fire is happening, you know, a fire at a scrapyard in Kensington that was large and burned for a very long time is also releasing plumes and carcinogens into the air, and you know, certainly dealt with concerns about that. And I think it's fair to say that maybe we should be looking at a different way to monitor what that impact looks like long term. You know, part of this is also about how do we balance those resource requests and how do we look at it going forward. But I think it's a fair point.
Yeah, an email from Corin who says, "I did outreach work about PES for an environmental organization in South Philadelphia. We found that most residents didn't know how they'd get information about an accident or what to do if an emergency siren went off. PES's management should be held accountable, but so should our local, state, and federal government bodies who let them operate a ticking time bomb in the middle of Philadelphia." If you want to go take that, Brian, just according to our caller here or an emailer, that people, even if there had been some kind of emergency of it's time to get out or something like that, people wouldn't know what to do.
I actually think we have a solid notification system that we would have been able to notify our surrounding residents if there was a need to evacuate. There was notification to shelter in place. And while there, while we have heard some concerns around how that was lifted and what the timing of it was and some of the communications around those notifications. I think the initial notification of shelter in place was received. That is something that we're going to continue to look at to make sure that that's accurate. But our Office of Emergency Management is well equipped to make sure that, that people are notified and know exactly what they need to do.
How were they notified? Just out of curiosity.
So there's text alerts, and we also can activate essentially emergency notification to cell phones. We have access to the emergency network.
But if people don't have a cell phone, is that are they in trouble?
There's one reason why we have a siren system in place. That siren system is tested every month. Mm-hmm. And you know, our Office of Emergency Management is prepared to help individuals develop personal emergency plans and emergency evacuations, and whether it's around fire, personal fire around a house, or whether it's around a larger natural disaster. We are reaching out into communities to try and make sure that people are prepared.
Anything you want to add to that, Peter? I know you're working with others on this community issue, community level of issue.
That's definitely outside of my area of expertise. But my understanding was that the emergency siren didn't initially go off with the explosion, and I think there was some concern about it took some time for that to happen. I know it is tested because I've heard that it is tested, and I've gotten notifications about that. But I don't know if that happened or at the 4 a.m. explosion. So
do you?
I don't know, and that again, that's going to be something that we look at closely to make sure that those notifications are properly done.
Comment from Warren: this facility closed 5 or 10 years ago. Then it was brought back out of bankruptcy. What is the plan for the workers then? I mean, we're back to the workers, of course.
Yeah, and back to the workers, and again, the city's going to do everything we can to protect those families and make sure they get the support they deserve.
And for the sort of environmental impact, is it this happened? Gosh, almost 2 weeks ago. I mean, is there any sort of residue left that you or others can look at to try to determine what happened or the impact of what happened?
I mean, I think the legacy of being around for 150 years is going to be more residue than this fire. This is not the first fire that's been at that complex, and it. Others have been more devastating in terms of loss of life and property. So, I think it is a long part of Philadelphia's history, but it might be time to move on so that we can start to clean up that space.
And the task force, looking ahead, what's your first order of business?
So initially we were hoping to convene this week. The announcement of the closure and the refocus of the task force has delayed that, but hopefully we will have at least an organizing meeting next week. We'll have a community meeting by the end of the month.
Oh, so down in the community near?
Yes.
Go ahead.
We're still committed to making sure that we hear those voices and that we can explain, at least to the best of our knowledge, what has happened and what the city is doing going forward.
And Peter, you'll continue to do the work that you've been doing, monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has been of interest for many years of my career now, and I am going to keep doing that. The question is, what is going to happen, and is air quality going to improve in the city? Is it is going to be measurable? These are important questions, and hopefully for the residents in the area, they may be able to breathe a little bit easier.
That literally?
Yeah.
I mean, figuratively and literally?
Yeah. No, I mean, in engaging with the community in the past, they complain often of smells and other things that affect them and affect their quality of life. And, if there's not an operating refinery where these chemicals are being emitted into their neighborhoods, they're not going to have that issue, hopefully, as much. And, it can't reverse the damages that have already been done, but it can be more healthy for people moving forward.
We're going to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for coming in, joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you so much. Peter DiCarlo, the voice you just heard, Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering and Chemistry at Drexel University. And again, his research focuses on climate and air quality. Brian Abernathy, and he is Philadelphia City Managing Director, also co-chair of this task force put together by Mayor Kenney to deal with the aftermath of the PES explosion, fire, and closure. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.